Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have a very important show on. I have a colleague who happens to be a physician and who's a psychiatrist. And I think it was time to have a show where we can talk about not just what's going on, but how we as human beings are reacting to it. Dr. Carl Benzio is a board-certified psychiatrist. He's a Christian, and he is well-trained in understanding not only mind, body, and spirit, but how you translate that into helping people and understanding people. He has a BSE in biomedical engineering with a focus in central nervous system imaging from Duke University. He graduated from the Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. He did a psychiatric training and residency at UC Irvine, and he has an expertise in psychological and spiritual principles into decision-making sciences and how it applies, which I think is very important. We get a lot of the bioethicist mentality, and this seems to me that this is the antithesis of that, because it brings humanity, spirituality, God into the equation. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Benzio, but the bioethicists seem to have the opposite effect. It's all secular. It's not God-driven. It's totalitarian. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think that a lot of times it gets very relativistic in not wanting to really look at absolutes, but trying to figure out what's best for the individual and sort of determined by the individual, and assuming that we can all be gods ourselves and know exactly what the past, present, and especially the future of certain decisions would be. And unfortunately, God is the only one who has that omniscience and has the power and has sort of put all of this together, especially our minds. Mm-hmm. And as any designer does, usually when they design something, they want people to get a lot out of it, and so they give them an instruction manual. And so God, creating our mind, says, hey, look, I'm not going to, Carl, make you figure out how to maximize it on your own. I'm going to give you this instruction manual called the BIBLE, the best instruction book for living every day, so that the abundant life will be clear to you how to lead that. And as our society and ethics, as we would like to call them, gets farther away from the absolutes of our designer, you can sort of see the chaos that ensues whenever we try to take that position of God and that role of God into our own hands. Think, oh, we know it all. We can figure it all out. We know what's going to happen 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if we sort of enact this policy and we let it play out. Mm-hmm. And we see sort of chaos ensue when we move away from God's principles.
Well, is there a bigger picture here on our society level of trying to separate people from an absolute, from God, and making everything very earth-driven? I mean, look at the election and this whole political environment that we find ourselves in. I've read stories constantly about families not speaking. You can't go to Christmas dinner. I mean, people are fighting and they're literally hurting each other because of a society that seems to be driven by, I need to win at all costs. Does it matter? There's no empathy. There's no compassion. How do we speak to each other in a way that will diffuse that?
Yeah, you know, this is really takes an emotional toll on people, like you said, whether it's families, whether it's in the workplace and coworkers not being able to talk to each other because it just incites too much antagonism and condemnation in the lunchroom or, in a meeting or in offhand comments. And we see it in our news, certainly. But, you know, our media and political climate usually is a reflection of the stress of our society. It's more of what we call a thermometer that sort of just shows us what the temperature is. It's not a thermostat that controls the temperature or the stress in our society. But like we talked about, as we get farther away from, you know, the last 20 or 30 years from biblical principles being pretty clear and pretty well understood and implemented in our society, you know, since the 60s and the significant revolution and of putting off the the government and the authority, and it's be freer, so to speak. We've got things that become a lot more stressful, and so now our media and our political system, really is a lot more causing of stress than it is sort of just a barometer, a thermometer of measuring the stress. Whenever I was a kid, we were told you shouldn't talk about religion, politics, or money, as if they were three separate entities. But now they're sort of all entwined, together. And as we've got these very controversial issues, starting in the 70s with abortion, and then over around 2000 with Kevorkian, physician-assisted suicide, but now with same-sex marriage or with transgender issues, the throwing out of what the absolutes are in our society has just created so much stress that, as Christians, it's hard for us to, as we see, non-biblical positions on things, trying to figure out, well, are we safe? What are we doing? As our kids are being indoctrinated at, in kindergarten, reading about two mothers, having a baby, or now that they're talking about sex ed coming in, so that to protect kids from predators of showing sexual acts in cartoon pictures for second, third, fourth graders. And is that grooming? Is that hypersexualizing? Or is that warning them and helping them be aware so that somebody doesn't try to do some of those things to very gullible second and third graders? So the stress level keeps on mounting. I think what Satan has done a good job of doing is sort of removing himself from the picture as he sort of orchestrates through worldly systems. And we fight against each other thinking that the other person is the enemy, instead of realizing, well, no, Satan's really the enemy in this process. And this other person is a child of God also. Mm-hmm. And how do I have compassion? How do I have compare for that, care for that person, and communicate to them in a way that's dignified, that's rational, that's honorable, that's respectful, and not trying to win the argument now, not trying to change them now. Very rarely does anybody change their position of 5, 10, 20 years in one conversation, even with the most dynamic speaker. But sometimes you feel compelled that, wow, we have to change this person now, or society is going to, drastically fall, and Sodom and Gomorrah kind of annihilation will happen to our town, country, region, whatever.
Well, that connection, that bridge that we were talking about, that empathy and compassion, it supersedes what the religion is. I mean, we can dig down, I would say, deeper into what makes us all human. And I think you have a really interesting story, because you were invited into Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, and you were invited by the Muslim religious section or segment of society, because it didn't matter that you were Christian. You had something that you could, a bridge that you could or help people bridge a divide that's causing great pain. And I think, I don't care who you are, if you're a soldier, if you're involved with things with death and destruction, it affects you. PTSD, traumatic brain injury, you name it, depression, suicide. These are all things that we can all understand. It doesn't matter who we are. And we're going to take our first break, but I'd like you to discuss, if you could, what that was like. It wasn't that you were Christian. It was that they understood you, and you could explain, and you could actually empathize. And I think we need to get to that point, whether we are for the same thing, we have a different take on things. We need, as a society, to get to that point, because divide and conquer, in my opinion, is not working. On that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution with Dr. Elena George. We're having a really important conversation with Dr. Carl Benzio. He is a psychiatrist and, I think, a forward-thinking human Christian and human being who's about the solution and how we can come together as opposed to what divides us. And before the break, I was trying to introduce your experience in Iraq. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, so back in 2007, I was the first psychiatrist invited into Iraq. The fall of Saddam Hussein had happened. We were at war in Iraq, and it was very significant conflict and combat and violence there. And unfortunately, that country had been under tyrannical regime for 30 years with much slaughter, desolation, high anxiety, high fear factor. And I was invited by the Minister of Health of Iraq to go in and do some consulting and do some teaching to their psychiatry and therapists and psychologists and primary care physicians, just because the suicide and addiction rate and depression was just so high in the country. And what they had been doing wasn't working, and they knew I was Christian, and 99% of the country is Muslim, but they knew they needed something much more powerful and potent, and they appreciated the spiritual aspect of the healing process, and they wanted to bring something that addressed the spiritual and was divinely empowered, and so they invited me in, and I had the opportunity to speak to a number of Muslim people. Some of them got converted, some of the professionals did, to Christianity in the process, but they, you know, I came in speaking science to them, so they appreciated me because of my scientific expertise and being able to meet them on that level. But as I talked and had credibility, you know, with them, with my discussion and talking about psychiatric principles, I then infused the spiritual elements of meaning, of purpose, of value, of connection, of love, of transcendental kind of thinking, that there's something bigger than us mm-hmm. out there. And because of their spiritual background, they also believed in those kind of things too. Now, being Muslim, they believed in a lot of the Old Testament, so we were able to talk about Old Testament principles. But then as I talked about leadership to the medical community, I used the example of Christ and Christ being a servant leader. And initially when I brought up leadership, they were all very afraid because they didn't want to be leaders, because under Saddam, if you were a leader, you were a potential threat, and you mysteriously disappeared or got killed or your family was threatened. So when I brought up leadership, they were real worried and concerned that I was going to put a bullseye on their back. Mm-hmm. But when I talked about leadership in a different way, using sort of a servant leadership model of Christ, they were very accepting of that, and they sort of saw Christ and Christianity in a much different way of care and compassion. And Jesus being sort of this revolutionary, you know, to me, he's a wonderful counselor and a great physician, so I'm biased, but I believe he's the perfect psychiatrist. And he started a behavioral health revolution of his very countercultural revolutionary thought of meekness, of humility, of service, and not seeing them as weaknesses, but seeing them as strengths to be able to care for people. And as I was speaking to caretakers, to healthcare workers, they really did want to care for people, but they didn't really know how to do it and how to express it because of their fear. And so I was able to help them overcome some of their anxieties and fears and use a biblical model to that, that a lot of them took to the point of actually converting from Islam to Christianity.
That's a really powerful testimonial, because we're seeing the same thing here.
In fact, piggybacking on that, just the, you know, I treat a lot of people that are homosexual. And they come into my office, they're referred by various primary care, usually primary care physicians, and the person has an issue with depression or anxiety or OCD. And the primary care person knows I'm pretty good at what I do and have a good success rate. And so the person comes into my office, they're not Christian, they see a lot of, the name of my practice was Lighthouse Psychiatry, so they see a lot of light symbolism of Christ and the light of the world and Bible verses in my office. But they are here to get some help. And as we talk to them about their particular issue, that they're depressed or they feel inadequate at work or they feel overwhelmed by financial pressures or the relationship that they're in, they know my position on homosexuality, but we discuss what they're there for, and I try to help them through that. And as I help them process those struggles and show care, show interest, ask them questions, involved in their life and their life story and hear their narrative, we start to unpack, you know, childhood and teenage issues that they had. And as we start to heal those issues, their homosexual feelings and same-sex attraction starts to melt. And just by caring for them and showing them God's love and compassion, and not condemning them, but just having a discussion with them, not compromising any of my principles, not condoning any sinful behaviors in any way, whether with them or other patients that I have that are sinning in various different ways, whether it's overeating or using drugs or whatever, we take a look and see, hey, how can we solve this? How can we work on the problems you've come here for? And as we do, and they see that compassion and they get some skills and equipping, it's amazing how some of their sinful behavior starts to subside in the process as God's presence and the way that God has designed our mind to work, as we start to use it that way, it's amazing how the abundant life starts to follow.
Well, it's about listening, isn't it? And having people be able to reveal and actually, as you said, unpack. But there's a lot of the brain is extremely powerful, isn't it? You can have an experience and it manifests in different ways depending on how you experience it and how you're able to understand it. Am I correct?
Yeah, you know, the good news is God gave us a powerful mind. The bad news is God gave us a powerful mind. You know, Satan understands that and is at work whenever we're 2, 3, 5, 7, 8 years old and we're so gullible that we're willing to believe in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and Satan is the master of deceit. He says, wow, if they're willing to believe all those things, I got a lot of lies I can start to, brainwash them with. And that's what those strongholds, footholds that the Bible calls them, or in psychology we call it baggage, that people have. And like you say, we all have these experiences in life, but what kind of lenses are we looking at them through? How are we interpreting them? To me, the parent's role, I have 3 daughters, and, my role as a parent is to try to interpret, translate life for them accurately so they can see the truth about what's happening and not allow Satan to start to plant lies about what's happening, that nobody likes you or you're ugly or you're fat or you have no friends or your parents are mean or, whatever lies that he wants to plant if I'm not accurately interpreting and translating their situations on the school bus or school or on the playground or whatever for them. And so, like you said, those experiences, not just the experiences themselves, but the lenses that we use, are we using godly lenses or do we use our flesh-centered lenses? And obviously when we're little, we have mainly flesh-centered lenses, so that's why we all have a lot of baggage and issues that we're a work in progress, going from milk to solid food, hopefully, as we are in that transformational process.
Well, I'd like to take what we just spoke about and apply it to our current political and social environment. We're in a different position now where you can actually go online and you can see what people said. You don't have to depend on their word. You can actually see. You can read what they wrote years ago. How are we in a position where people are so focused on what they're being told or what they're being told to feel? Because you look a certain way, because you're from a certain era, you should feel this. This is your hat that you need to wear. This is the team you need to belong to. And people totally ignore or basically not even try to do their own due diligence and their own research. You're told, so it must be true. How do we get people out of that? And it's not unlike your faith, which is different. This is a worldly entity trying to drive you into a mindset that in most times works against you. So how do we get people to take a step back and be willing? And in a sense, you have to be vulnerable because you have to give up what your theory of something is. And actually, maybe I'm wrong. I'll have to take a look at that. How do you get people to do that?
Well, that's a great point. The we're unfortunately, most of us are spiritually and psychologically lazy. The stress of the day, the energy it takes to get through the day, to tweeze out these finer points of life, we often don't have the energy for, because it takes time, it takes energy to look at these things, to discern, what did this person say, and what really is the truth, and, there's a lot of gray area, and so, in society, we don't like to be in the gray area. We like to be on black or white. We look at it very binary. So most of life is really the gray area. God gave us food. Food is really in the gray area. Eating all the time isn't good. None of the time isn't good. It's really somewhere in the middle. Work all the time isn't good. Work none of the time isn't good. But, to try to figure out, where in the gray area is work today? Is it at 70? Is it 30? Is it 20? Well, that takes work. That takes effort. That takes some due diligence, like you said. So being able to, we all feel inadequate. We all feel insecure, as we're young. And so having people tell us stuff sometimes makes more sense than me trying to figure out on my own. And to try to find that balance of what is me being able to figure out and then to be able to trust good authoritative sources about the things I'm not sure about. Sometimes we trust the right sources and sometimes we trust the wrong sources because we do want to belong. We do want to affiliate. We know that, God designed us to belong to Him. So we know we need to belong to something. So we're trying to gravitate somewhere, but then there's a lot of false teachers saying, well, now here, gravitate here, here's where you belong. And I think for each person to know that they're uniquely designed, and God has made each person in a special way, with special giftings and skills, and a special path in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to look like anybody else's path. It might have similarities, and certainly we all have some similarities in our life, whether it's because of the town we grew up in, the family that we come from, the color of our skin, the gender that we're born as, the things that we like to do, the church that we go to, the community that I live in. There's some commonalities, but there's also so much uniqueness involved in, and how to be able to allow a person to explore that and understand it, but do it within the confines and the safety of a loving environment, people that care for them, that are trying to foster that individuality, but also seeing the fit in the bigger family, whether that's their family of origin biologically, whether that's their community, whether that's their church group, whether that's brothers and sisters in Christ. You know, there's belonging many places, but there's also an individuality and how to be able to marry the two instead of just being lost in a group or being totally individualistic and I don't care, I don't want to affiliate with anybody. And mm-hmm. do my own thing. Either one of those is, again, on the opposite ends of the spectrum that just isn't going to work.
You know, what you said about us being unique and given gifts, and I mean, that is the antithesis of collectivism and the social construct that some folks on the left are trying to, foist on everybody. Just because it's us again, you know, a monolith, everybody's the same, or everybody's a victim, or everybody should think a certain way. And everybody, how can I put it? You're not special, you're a victim, which is really makes no sense. We're not equal, we're different. You have a skill that I don't have, and it's not a value statement. It just is, and it's a great thing. If we were all the same, it'd be very boring. God didn't do that, right? So how do we, again, separate ourselves from that mindset of not just belonging, but being the same? And anybody who has a question mark, they're shut down, they're put out of business, they are demonized, literally, for having an opinion that doesn't fit the whole. How did we get into that situation? How do you get out of that situation?
Yeah, you know, I think our society has gotten very hypersensitive. And I just saw just a report today in the news that there's some conflict in Congress because a senator said that all the things you need to know about coronavirus are on the CDC website, and one website in a nice, concise way that's really updated on this Chinese virus. And he used the term Chinese virus. And then some person said that's being racist. And so this, you know, just the hypersensitivity that we have in society that is so divisive, the lack of resiliency that we have with this microwave society, and sometimes we want things so immediate that, again, having that that ability to be bored or just wait or to have some patience mm-hmm. or some self-control for answers or to think through something on our own or to gather data or information to make an intelligent response or to understand the problem before we enact some solution of it. You know, I grew up in the 70s, and we're just starting to get electronics coming out, but we had, three stations. So you actually had to get up and change the station or watch commercials. And at night, the TV went off at 1:30, that you just got this signal on there. But now everything is just so constant, and the stimulation is so constant, and for people to be bored, for kids to be bored for, for 10 seconds, they need to be looking at their social media and at their phone and getting more information, getting more data. Instead of sifting through and thinking about the data they have, they're just building a bigger library and not a better application process. And a lot of times in Christianity, I see people that are taking in more Bible and more Bible studies and more podcasts and more webinars and more church services, and they're building great libraries, but like we talked about in the very beginning, what's the application process of that?
Let me stop you for 1 second. We need to take our second break and come right back and pick up where we left off. You're Living in the Solution.
You're listening to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George, healthcare consumer advocate.
Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Benzio, and you can find his information on www.lighthousenetwork.org. Before the break, I think you were going into a really important area with the distractions and constant stimulation, but it's not positive stimulation. As you said before, people are feeling bad about themselves. They're too heavy. They need to have more hair. It's something that's usually negative that makes people either want to not engage or online engage in ways that are totally false, you know, false profiles and catfishing people. It's not about honesty. It's about how you want to be perceived as opposed to being happy with who you are. And is that disconnection between feeling really at peace with yourself and good about yourself versus what society tells you should feel, is that a conflict that's causing depression, anxiety, and the things that we see mushrooming?
I think so. I think that we have two forces. One is our establishment or our government sort of devaluing people. People are more of a commodity, as we see abortion, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, the legalization of drugs. The people's value is going down. It's, they're only as good as the person in charge thinks that they have value and they can contribute to society. Right now, addictions is our number one killer in the United States and suicide is number two. Mm. So we sort of have this from the top and from the authority communicating a certain lack of value, lack of purpose, lack of importance. But then from the individual view, we, like I said, we're sort of born inadequate and insecure. That's sort of the status of our fleshly self. But then with all the social media, you know, when I was a kid, most people grew up sort of the towns they were born in. And so you're around the same people all the time. So it was really hard to hide who you were. You know, your grandparents, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, the people next door, the people at your church, the people at the supermarket, they were all pretty much the same people. And they saw you from when you came home from the hospital till you graduated high school. So you really couldn't put on a false air mm-hmm. in front of most of those people. But since the 70s, 80s, our society has gotten much more mobile and people move away. They move around for jobs for whatever reasons because it's easier to fly, to drive, to have a much more mobile society. And that, you know, allows for a lot of benefits, but there's some significant difficulties as far as the relational attachments that people have and being able to be open and expose themselves to the people around them because now these are new people. Well, they might not accept me for who I am, so I have to hide my skeletons. I have to hide my warts. I have to present something much different or much grander to them for their acceptance, for them to approve of me, to not reject it. Then you blend in social media, which, you know, you see other people's high points of their life. You think, wow, they're beautiful, they're awesome, they're going on vacation, they have these wonderful things. And my life is terrible. And then there's bullying, there's sexting, there's mm-hmm. shaming. It goes on when somebody posts something and how many likes or how many shares, and, you know, comparing followers. And so there's all this sort of almost Hollywoodish kind of glitz and glamour and superficiality. But now it's brought to everybody and everybody is exposed to it, sort of part of that game in a diabolical way. So even though people have, you know, 4,000 friends on Facebook or, you know, 1,000 followers on Instagram, they don't really have friends. They're not really close to people. They don't have an accountability, a vulnerability, a closeness, a real shoulder to cry on. So some people would term the phrase crowded loneliness. You know, amongst all the crowds, people are still lonely. And we need connection. We need somebody to hear us. We need somebody to share our story with and to share their story with them. But that's happening less and less. So then trying to find other ways to connect, whether it's with having a relationship with alcohol or with pornography or an eating disorder or cutting or being anxious, low self-esteem, all the different behavioral health manifestations of psychiatric and addiction illnesses. We're continuing to see rises in those, whereas, like I said, addiction is the number one killer mm-hmm. and suicide the number two killer in our society.
Well, actually, that leads me to the next question. Since social media and the internet got rolling, because, you know, you've been in practice, I mean, you're not old or anything, not to say that, but have you seen an explosion in Hey, I'm about the same age, don't worry. Depression, anxiety, with the growth of social media, I don't think I've ever seen so many people come in on antidepressants in my office. Young people with anxiety. I mean, children with anxiety. Is it because this lack of connection? Is it something that's creating this mental illness? Is it increasing naturally? I guess that's my question. Is it organically increasing, or is it being driven?
Well, I think that our brain chemistry is determined mostly by the decisions that we make. When we make good decision-making is what I call the exercise for the brain. When we make good decisions, our brain chemistry, the actual circuits of our brain, the synapses, the connections, the neurotransmitters, actually get stronger and better. Hmm. And we make wrong decisions, our brain chemistry gets corrupted, short-circuited, chemical imbalance. And that's why the Bible talks about the renewing of our mind. The renewing of our mind happens when we make godly decisions. And the corrupting of our mind or double-mindedness is when we make wrong decisions. So as kids, unfortunately, we're making lots of wrong decisions. So we have sort of some chemical short-circuiting that's happening as kids that hopefully as we're maturing and we're starting to make more good decisions, we're starting to undo and redevelop that circuit and rewire, renew our mind, as the Bible would say, to become a healthier, more godly mindset. So I think as our society has become much more fragmented and disjointed, there's not as much role modeling, not as much leadership. There's more anxiety, more fear. I was a kid that moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. So I struggled with anxiety, depression, and became an alcoholic. But certainly a big influencer was as I would move from place to place, I would make friends. But then as we'd move away, I'd lose friends. And move another place, make friends, lose friends. And when you do that a few times, you're like, well, why should I make friends if I'm just going to lose them again and go through a grieving process? So I started to isolate off and not make friends and just become, okay, well, I'm just going to manage myself and be a loner in the process. That'll protect me from hurts, but it doesn't allow me any connection either. And so I think a lot of people are being more disconnected. Therefore, they're making decisions on their own. As an 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old, well, that's never a good guide. You know, another 12-year-old guiding a 12-year-old in decision-making. To have those authorities, to have those leaders. Another significant element that we see is about a third of the kids now are raised in homes with either no biological parent or only one biological parent. And a bunch of those homes that have both biological parents, a lot of times they're, working. So you're being raised by daycare or sitters or those kind of things. So having that stable entity in the house for nurturing, for care, you're valuable to us. Mm-hmm. You're important to us. You're that important that I'm willing to stay home and watch you and take care of you and be part of your life. I think that communicates something to the children that I'm inadequate. I'm not worthy. I don't have value. I don't have purpose. So I think those kind of elements start to swirl together. And so, like I said, anxiety, ADHD, various behavioral problems because of that chemical imbalance, because of more wrong decisions happening, we're starting to see a manifestation of that process on brain chemistry and then we see it in the office. Now, as you piggyback on that, okay, well, I'm going to try to cope with my anxiety, my frustration. Well, people look to social media and look to their phones now to cope. So now they look at somebody else's Facebook page or they look at somebody else's post. And now you can look on Facebook and you can find things about people that are cutting to relieve their pain or to feel better, mm-hmm. or losing weight or anorexic or purging. We've had at Honey Lake Clinic, where I'm a medical director, we've had significant cases of girls getting caught up in social media and comparing themselves and seeing themselves as inadequate or overweight or not as pretty as. And on the guy's side, they get caught up in video gaming, and where you can play a game and you're playing guys in Japan and Russia and Germany and Canada, and so that's your social circle, so to speak. No real friendships. Yeah, you see them every day online, but then they get caught up in that and they're dropping out of college, they're not going to work, they're living in their parents' basement. We even had one kid who attacked his mom just because he started to get psychotic of using marijuana and watching video games, playing video games all the way through the night, and ended up attacking his mother with a knife because he was just so delusional. So those are the sort of conspiring of all these ingredients together to make just a terrible recipe.
Man, that's amazing. And we have a minute or so, but before we take our next break, I wanted to ask you about people on gaming and these EMF frequencies bombarding people, 4G, 5G. Does that have any kind of effect on brain chemistry?
Well, that's, I don't know if our science is quite there yet. You know, you would think that it's not the healthiest thing. It's got to have some play. You know, even just the spoken word. You know, to me, there's just power in the spoken word. A dear friend who passed away, Fran McCabe, was one of the world's renowned people in harmonics and wave theory. And just in talking with him about just the sound waves and how sound waves affect the brain chemistry. And I think people knew that in the Old Testament, and they would name their kids certain things for specific reasons. And as a kid hears that name, it's actually spoken. There's just a harmonic, and just the waves as it affects brain chemistry. And we know that from music. You know, there's certain musical notes and rhythms. I'm not a musical person, but that we use for weddings, and there's a different one that we use for war, and there's a different ones we use for funerals, that they just communicate something in our brain and connect with something in our brain. So our brain is this very sensitive, complex organ. And I think anything that puts out, you know, some kind of biology or some kind of physics or chemistry is going to affect our brain. The closer it gets to our brain, the more effect it has on it, as we see with alcohol, as we see with caffeine, as we see with marijuana. Opioids, you know, I think there's other unseen, but because of physics, you know, whether it's, you know, 5G, whether it's, you know, signals from our microwave, whether it's signals from our, you know, the cell phone I'm talking to you right now on that's right next to my ear over and over and over. Wow, what kind of impact is that having on us?
That's a really good question. And people need to think about that. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Living the Solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Benzio, a psychiatrist and somebody who is, you're blessed if you live in the same town and you have a child or you have an issue, because this is a comprehensive view of the whole person. I haven't heard you once talk about you need to take a medication to fix this, right? It's deeper than that. It's fixing the problem. It's getting to the root cause. It's getting to the cellular, the spiritual portion of what makes us, isn't it?
You know, I've been practicing since 89, over 30 years now. And I've been prescribing psychiatric medications, and believe me, psychiatric medications are miracles. They're a wonder that we have them, and they've helped many, many people over my 30 years, thousands of people. But I've never seen them cure anybody yet. They're not the cure for anything. As we talked about, our brain chemistry is very sensitive, and it's the psychological and spiritual skills that we need to put into play and learn that affect our brain chemistry much more. It's just that those skills sometimes take time to learn, practice, and implement and to bear fruit. Medications are a quick band-aid. You know, they attach our brain chemistry, and they help us with certain things, whether it's thinking, whether it's attention, whether it's decreasing our anxiety, helping our mood, but they're just like a blood pressure medication. You know, blood pressure medication never cures anybody's hypertension, but it does help with the symptoms so the person doesn't have a heart attack or a stroke. But if the person doesn't learn any psychological life management or spiritual skills, they're going to die of a heart attack. No matter how much, you know, you can maybe be on 3 or 4 different blood pressure medications, but if you keep on eating the way you do, not exercising, have poor communication skills, conflict resolution skills, financial management skills. You get your value and your purpose from people's opinions and not from God and from Christ's blood and practicing biblical principles of life management. You're going to die of a heart attack or a stroke. And the same way with our brain. Our brain is a very sensitive organ. It's amazing how spiritual and psychological skills really can renew the mind and transform a person's life. But it takes a while to start to learn to practice those skills for them to bear fruit and undo years and years and years poor decision-making on our part. And so medications are a nice patch to buy us time, just like blood pressure medications are a nice patch to buy the person time to start to implement the skills, and maybe 6 months, 9 months later, they start to bear fruit. Now we can start lowering those blood pressure meds similar psychiatrically. Once we start to practice those psychological and spiritual skills, then we can start to hopefully get some impact on that, or whatever that psychiatric illness is, depression, OCD, anxiety, substance abuse, then we can start to back off on some of those medications once life starts to move in the right direction.
I guess a corollary to that question is, you know, the word trigger has become pretty popular over the past 4 or 5 years. What does that exactly mean? I mean, I've seen it on the internet, and it's not pretty. But what is it exactly from a psychological standpoint?
So a trigger, a lot of people say, especially my teenagers, I'm triggered. And we're just on vacation with our family, and, my wife said something, and my daughter said, oh, I'm triggered. And so a trigger is, a stimulus could be, and a stimulus could be a person, an event, something you hear, something you see. It could be something on social media, something you hear on the news. But it's some event or situation that provokes an emotional reaction. Now, usually the way we use a trigger more significantly is usually it's a pretty significant negative emotional reaction. And what's being triggered or being unearthed is some past hurt or wound that now the present situation is sort of mimicking or reminding us or bringing up that past much bigger wound or hurt than what my wife said in the car. What she said in the car was relatively benign, but since it mimicked or reminded my daughter of a past wound or hurt she had, all of a sudden she has a little bit more of a reaction. Now it was sort of gamier or just a jest that she mentioned it, but that's where we usually use the term trigger. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, the individual isn't aware that they're even being triggered, but all of a sudden they're having a sort of a 50-unit reaction to something that just required a 5-unit reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an exaggerated reaction, and that person, why did I just go off on that person, or why did I become so fearful or anxious around that person? All they did was they said something, or they maybe were wearing a tie of somebody who had been a perpetrator in their life that wore a tie. So they're not even aware of, they're being reminded of this past wound, but yet they're having an exaggerated reaction for what this particular present situation warrants, but it's very similar to the past wound or hurt or trauma had.
What do you think the connection with societal triggering? For example, if you're part of, let's say, because of the way the left is defining who's a victim group, if you happen to be a white male or not of a minority group, so to speak, why are people becoming or apologizing for things that they've never done, that they don't feel, that they're not racist, but they're apologizing and somehow taking on the guilt? And it goes both ways. Of kids who are in Ivy League schools, the 1% complaining about how they're victims, but they really are the 1%. How on earth psychologically does that work on people?
I think, Satan is incredible at deceit and trickery. And, I think we all have these certain desires, whether somebody apologizing or feeling guilty about something, there's empathy for a certain situation, but trying to figure out, well, what do I do now based on this particular situation?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do I really unpack that problem and see, well, what really is the problem? And then what really is the healthy solution? Instead of a knee-jerk, I see there's a victim, so I'm not really sure what to do. I know that there's something I could probably do, so I'm going to feel guilty about it. And that's sort of what ends up resonating, as opposed to, well, let me go through a thoughtful process of scrutinizing and unpacking and doing some discovery. And then, what's my role in it? What's that person's role in it? What's this person's role in it? How do we come together as a collective to figure out, okay, I bring this skill, you bring that skill, you bring this position, you're a physician, you're a social worker, how do we have sort of a multidisciplinary or a team approach to the situation using the skills and abilities that this whole group can bring together, as opposed to I have to do everything or I'm the victim of everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that ability to sort of sift through and be a thinker. But whenever we think, we have to think based on something. You know, what are the absolutes that we're using? Is it a very postmodern, relativistic kind of thought process, or is there something that has more absolutes attached to it? You know, my life verse is Isaiah 23. He gives them perfect peace, whose mind is fixed on me, because he trusts you. And, you know, when I was a kid on the playground, they had these things called roundabouts that spun around, and, you know, you jump on it, and the big kids would spin it around, and after a while, they'd stop it, and you'd get off, and everybody would be dizzy and stumbling and bumbling, and every once in a while, a kid would throw up. And the people that sort of won, so to speak, were the ones that were like, oh, if I fix my gaze on the water fountain, on the pavilion, on that tree, I won't get dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in life, I think it's the same way. We have many people with dizziness, with nausea, with overwhelmed, with confusion, with disorientation, because they're not fixed on God. We're fixed on the things of this world, whether that's politically, whether that's racially, whether that's, you know, here's what your identity is supposed to be or should be based on what's on Facebook or what somebody shamed you, in a post or whatever. As opposed to, well, no, here's a fixed, absolute, steady, rock solid, never changing, you know, before, now, and forever God. How do I get my value, my purpose, and answers from him, as opposed to what Satan and the world are going to throw at, are constantly changing and are going to make me double-minded and disoriented and confused all the time?
That's a really good analogy. I really like that. Because it seems like that you never have any kind of foundation, and that makes you, in my opinion, vulnerable to whoever can sway you, whoever can make you feel supposedly good for this moment. But it's fleeting, you know, like you described before. I mean, if you don't really understand yourself, if you don't understand what motivates you, if you don't have a purpose, right, and it's bigger than you, not you in relationship to each other necessarily, but something bigger, God. You know, I'm here for a purpose. I'm here for a reason, and I'm going to pursue that. Nothing's going to get in my way. But in that process, I'm going to be compassionate. I'm going to be positive. I'm going to be a solution. All those things help you make it, I think, as you described before, good decisions. We're all human. We're going to make mistakes. But I think if you're doing things for the right reason, and it doesn't come out the way you want it to, I think you can live with that. You know, most people who do things that way seem to get over it. You know, you lick your wounds, you pick yourself up, and you keep going. But if it's to hurt somebody, if it's a negative and you have a bad outcome, somehow it just seems to feed on itself the opposite way. And so you have to make someone feel worse than you do so you can feel good about yourself. Is that reasonable?
Well, you know, I think, we often look at God and say, well, God really wants our obedience. And he's given us the Ten Commandments and, there's the law of the Old Testament and stuff. But, you know, if you really look at God, if he could have our obedience and our relationship, he would take them both. But if he had to choose one or the other, boy, I want to have a relationship with Carl or I want Carl's obedience, he'd much rather have a relationship with me than my obedience. You know, we see it with the sinners on the cross next to Jesus. We see it in, you know, the story of Mary and Martha. You know, if you think of it this way, if I have one daughter who gets straight A's, she does all her chores, she does her homework, she never needs to be told, what to do, and she's always doing the right thing. But she doesn't like me. She doesn't care for me. She's not interested in what I'm interested in. She doesn't care if I'm happy or sad. She doesn't want to come on do chores with me. Versus daughter number two, who, she gets B's and C's. She needs help with her chores every once in a while. She needs reminded or picked up after. She needs some correction from the neighbors every once in a while. I get a call from the neighbors that she's doing something, but she loves me. She cares for me. She wants to, hey, Dad, look, I got this new CD. I want you to listen to it and tell me what your opinions are. Hey, I'm having a struggle with this friend at school. Can you give me some advice or help me with this? Or, hey, Dad, let's go hang out and, watch a game together. You know, which one would you rather have? right?
Yeah.
And so we'd rather have that relationship rather than obedience. Whether it's these wedge issues, whether these controversies, whether these difficult things, I think that's what God really values, is relationship. How do I value relationship? How do I show God's love and God's compassion for this person through me and not let me think of that person as my enemy? Satan is my enemy. He wants to divide me from that person. We don't want to compromise, just like Daniel didn't compromise his principles, but he wasn't disrespectful, wasn't crazy, and wasn't condemning, and wasn't maligning of his captors. He's gracious. He was relatable. He was relational. He was respectful, but didn't compromise the word, but showed the value of relationship at the same time. Sometimes I think we forget that, and we value obedience over relationship, but I don't think God values them quite in that priority direction.
How can people reach you?
Well, my cell number is 215-630-8846. I don't mind giving out my cell number to hear from people that are struggling or need some help. My email is kbenzio, B-E-N-Z-I-O, at honeylake.clinic. And like you said, www.lighthousenetwork.org and www.honeylake.clinic. I'm the medical director of Honey Lake Clinic, so you can reach me via those websites or via that email or giving me a call on my cell phone.
Dr. Benzio, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor and a pleasure. I hope you'll come back in the future.
Likewise. God bless all your listeners. And life, decisions determine your life, so choose well, everyone.
On that note, thank you for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.